This is Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce you to my guest today, Tim Johnston, the author, co-author actually, with Donald McGregor, of the book His Own Man, the biography of Otto Peltzer, champion athlete, Nazi victim, and Indian hero. Tim is also, full disclosure, an old school chum. We were at boarding school together in England. Tim is speaking to us from The Hague via Skype. It's really lovely to be talking to you again, Tim. So welcome to the program, and congratulations on the publication of your first book.
Well, thanks very much, Hazel.
You know, I must confess, I'm the last person in the world you'd expect to read a biography about a sports figure. When I started to thumb through His Own Man, I grimaced a bit, quite honestly, at the pages, the several chapters, actually, of technical running data about a champion athlete. But I was wrong. The grimace was misplaced. I actually found it a fascinating story, beautifully told. Dr. Otto Peltzer is, as you say, an exceptional individual, living in extraordinary times. Your chapter headings are very evocative. Otto the patriot, the runner, the student, Otto the strange, the schoolmaster, persona non grata, the exile, against the background in Europe of the First and Second World Wars. So how does Otto Peltzer's life begin?
He was born with the 20th century in April 1900, which turns out to be quite significant because he was born within 3 or 4 months of Heinrich Himmler. Their paths crossed. You know, it was only chance, if you like, the fact that he was born into a high bourgeois family, whereas Himmler was born into a low bourgeois family, that their lives took such different courses. So, yes, he was born in 1900, which meant that as an athlete, he was at his peak in the Weimar years. That was when he had his main career. But he was still only 33 when Hitler came to power. Uh-huh. And he thought he could still play a part in the Reich. In fact, he joined the SS and he applied for a job as Commissar for Sport. He didn't, in fact, get for all kinds of reasons. But one of the most significant things about him was that he was homosexual. He was probably the first world-famous gay athlete, which made very little difference under Weimar. But of course, as soon as Hitler came to power, it was quite a different situation. They would have got him anyway, because he didn't fit in. The title of the book is His Own Man. He was an individualist. He was never the sort of person that could fit into the Nazi mold. And in fact, very early on, as a member of the SS, he was invited to address the SS on racial policy, which had been the subject of his doctorate. The Nazi perversion of eugenics, which was a very okay subject in its time, was simply wrong. That was enough to get him kicked out of the SS. And he was very outspoken. In some ways, he was like Oscar Wilde. He was an innocent. He was both arrogant and innocent, and he didn't appreciate how much danger he was in. So if they hadn't got him for homosexuality, they would have got him for something else. So after various comings and goings, he ended up in Mauthausen concentration camp, which actually at the time was the toughest. It was Stufe 3, whereas Auschwitz was only Stufe 2. Heydrich joked, he called it the Knochenmühle. People were ground to death. They were worked to death. As a homosexual, he was given the worst job of all. He worked in the quarry. He was a very fit man, and he survived it. He came out of the camp at the end of the war. After several months, he discovered that his whole family had been wiped out by the Red Army. But instead of taking a revanchist line, on the contrary, he said, you know, there's been enough killing. Let's all try and make peace with one another. He actually had many friends in the East. And in fact, that was his problem. The people in the West, many of his enemies, got quickly denazified and came back into power.
So East and West, you meant East Germany and West Germany.
Yes.
And also, and just to point out, the Mauthausen, the concentration camp, was in Austria, right?
Indeed, very much so. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there were more concentration camps in Austria than anywhere else in the Reich, apart from Poland. It was like a sea of concentration camps. All the secret weapons were being built and dug into the mountains in Austria.
You haven't really talked very much about Otto as an athlete.
At the age of 7, he got polio. He ended up being plastered up for several months. Mm-hmm. His family moved to Prussia, but he was left behind in Holstein, where the family came from, pretty much to his own devices. He was bullied when he went to school. He was treated as an outsider. He prayed that he would be ill so he didn't have to go to school. But in the meantime, having got himself out of plaster, he used to go for walks and then runs in the countryside, and he gradually built up his strength.
Who was he living with?
He lived with his grandmother. He was sent to boarding school for a while. But the point was, he was always an outsider. He felt that he was an outsider. He hadn't even heard of athletics as a sport. And when he was 17, he joined the army. His first introduction to sport was in the army, was in sprinting and throwing the hand grenade and jumping into trenches, that kind of thing.
This was in 1917, so the First World War.
1917, yeah. He got as far as Berlin. He was what was called an ensign. He got as far as Belgium. He was just about ready to join the front when Germany surrendered. He wasn't that keen on athletics. He was keen on sport. You know, they had all these youth groups in Germany in the period following the First World War. He rapidly became prominent in these youth groups and was their representative. He was a very competent speaker. He shared that with Hitler. He could speak off the cuff more or less indefinitely. He studied in Munich, and he was there at the time of Hitler's putsch, but one can assume from his general conduct that he was never a Nazi. Even though he applied to join the party, his application was actually refused.
Because he was a homosexual?
They never told him. What is not generally realized, it wasn't anybody who could become a party member. You certainly couldn't become a member without first being vetted. We don't know whether it was because he was a homosexual or for other reasons. But as an athlete, some of the members of his youth group said, look, you know, you seem to be a pretty good runner. Why don't you try and do it seriously? And persuaded him to join a club. He was an extremely competitive person. Very quickly, he found that he was winning races and moving very rapidly up the ladder. And within 2 or 3 years, he had become an international runner. And his great hope was to run in the Paris Olympics. This was the time of the Ruhr occupation. There was a lot of anti-German feeling, and it was felt not appropriate. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that Germany was the only World War combatant country that wasn't invited. So already by 1924, he was good enough to run in the Olympics, but it wasn't to be, and it was very frustrating. His great year was 1926. He ran against the Brit, who had won the gold in the Paris Olympics 2 years before. And he went to London and he ran against him and he beat him and he set a new world record. So that was pretty good, but there was better still to come, because 2 months later he ran against the man who was synonymous with running, Pavel Nurmi, the Flying Finn, in Berlin, and he beat Nurmi. Nobody beat Nurmi. I mean, that's not to say that Nurmi never lost a race, but he never lost an important race. Mm-hmm. And this was a key race, and he beat Nurmi. So by the end of 1926, he was the star.
He was very proud to be representing Germany, right?
He was brought up on Greek history and on German history, and on the history of the German sagas. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be a hero. He really wanted to be a hero, and he was searching, where can I be a hero? And he found athletics was where he could be a true German hero. And the next thing was, the Americans came along and they offered him $250,000. I mean, imagine, that is millions. Turned professional. And he said, no, I'm an amateur and I want to represent Germany in the next Olympics. And he refused. Instead, he went to teach in this progressive school, Vickersdorf. They were the two leading progressive schools, Vickersdorf and I forget the other one. He went to teach at Vickersdorf for an absolute pittance.
I mean, he came from a well-off family, right?
Yeah.
And so he had money.
Yeah.
At this stage, anyway, he had money. So working for a pittance was not such a hardship?
Yes. He came from a well-off family, and they had assets. They had mm-hmm. a farm. They had quite a big estate in Prussia. Mm-hmm. But he was still living on next to nothing. He was always borderline. he was always being accused of professionalism, particularly by the French. And they accused him of drug taking, they accused him of professionalism, and he somehow always managed to wriggle out of it. He would be invited to run all over the country, and he would say, all right, I will run, but also I will give a lecture, and I will be paid for this lecture. So really a piece of sophistry, which was borderline. But there were others who were disqualified. The amateur code was very strictly enforced in those days.
So this was part of his individualism, that he did what he wanted to do. He was his own man. And he flouted these things. But yet, somehow he got away with it.
He was a very convincing talker. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things.
He was charismatic, wasn't he?
Yes, he was indeed. He was charming, that's for sure.
But he was also a great athlete, a great runner. And the crowds, I mean, he had huge crowds.
He had huge crowds, and they loved to watch him. And one of the things was that his finish, he said himself that he never knew until like the last 100 meters whether he was going to win or not. But he had this absolutely devastating sprint. I mean, I've seen a short video of it. If he was there in the last straight, he would suddenly sort of press a switch and his whole style would change and whoosh, he'd be away and he would win. Of course, the crowds absolutely loved him for that.
But he also had these, what you call stork legs, as in the stork bird.
Yes, and his own family christened him the stork because his father used to take them out in the woods on Sunday morning and he would give his brother and sister a start and then run them down. And so they called him the stork.
What is stork in German?
Okay. Storch, S-T-O-R-C-H.
Storch. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a very strong feeling from the book. I mean, as I said, the technical data, you know, means absolutely nothing to me. But our audience should know that the first many chapters do document very closely each of his races in terms of hours or minutes or seconds. There's another point that I'd like to make and that you haven't made, and that you yourself were an Olympic runner. I presume one of the reasons you wrote this book.
Yes, indeed.
But all those metrics and measurements of time were meaningful to you, obviously, as a runner. And there are people who read sporting histories and people perhaps in our audience to whom this kind of information is of great interest. But he also wrote a lot. And in the end, he got a PhD as well.
PhD was in eugenics, which is an absolute taboo subject. But at the time, everybody was in favor of eugenics. You know, all the great minds of the time, Bernard Shaw, Murray Stopes, anybody who was anybody on the left was in favor of eugenics.
What was the argument?
If you could improve the breeding stock, if you could somehow discourage the poor from breeding, you could improve the breeding stock. That was the basic idea of the thing. But of course, it got completely perverted by the Nazis.
He was considered a left-leaning person.
Yeah.
So he was known as a homosexual all the way through all of this?
I don't think it was important in the Weimar period.
So the Weimar period, that was the time of the cabaret, right? The music.
Well, exactly. They were sex tourists, basically, the people like Isherwood and Spender and Auden.
Spender and W.H. Auden and Christopher Isherwood.
And all those people. They went to Berlin for the boys, essentially, the same as today, you know, the sex tourists, they go to Thailand or wherever it is. But the idea was the same.
Tim Johnston is talking about his new book, His Own Man, the biography of Otto Peltzer. This is Hazel Kahn with Tidings on WPKN Radio. So that was the Weimar period. He wasn't part of that, though, right?
He may have been homosexual, but homosexual was not his main thing. Sport was his main thing. On the other hand, he did have boyfriends. One of his main boyfriends was so beautiful that he was chosen to carry the torch in the 1936 Olympics. He was specially selected, Fritz Schilgen, and he was one of Peltzer's boyfriends. The whole business of homosexuality, it was controversial, but at the same time, it wasn't shameful. And you had this tradition of the Teutonic hero and the Greek heroes. You know, I mean, after all, Alexander the Great was a homosexual. The point about it changing was, first, their suggestions that Hitler himself in his youth had been homosexual. It didn't really matter while he was just another sort of rabble-rousing politician. But once he became respectable, it was absolutely essential that that past should be wiped out. Hitler was trying to cover up his past, and suddenly, almost without warning, homosexuality, rather than becoming a minor offence, became in effect a felony.
You report in the book, he was interrogated by Himmler and then jailed, and Himmler said to him, "Tell me why you don't like women." But we don't know, there's no record of what Otto...
what he responded. What is interesting about Himmler and the SS and homosexuality was that, according to Peltz's coach, Brustmann, who actually plays quite an important part in the book, who was actually Peltz's political protector, he kept him out of camp for much longer than he would otherwise have been. And Brustmann became a personal sex doctor to many of the senior SS. After the war, Brustmann claimed the trouble with the SS, the trouble with Himmler, is he wanted to create this band of warriors who would be devastatingly attractive to women, you know, and breed from them. The trouble was they were even more devastatingly attractive to one another.
I see.
And in fact, among the SS, homosexuality was a capital offence.
What this book does so interestingly is the way it traces Otto Peltz's rise and fall, but to place him very, very firmly in the political, geopolitical times.
He was like all athletes, you know, they're bipolar. And when things are going well, the confidence is high. And when things are going badly, then suddenly they collapse.
What things went badly for him?
Well, the Olympics. In 28, he was absolutely the top favorite. In 1926, he'd beaten two world records. In 1927, he broke a third. He was the hot favourite for the 28 Olympics, but he foolishly got a quite stupid injury. Athletes are very specialised people. He wasn't content to be a specialist, and he loved playing all sports. In fact, he was playing handball, and he slipped, and somebody trod on his foot and broke a bone. And that was just 3 months before the Olympics. He managed miraculously to take part in the Olympics, but he was way, way below his best. Mm-hmm. The British team even presented him with a sort of honorary medal, saying, "Well, you didn't win the gold, but you deserve to win." There was a letter that they all signed, and that became one of Otto's most treasured possessions. And then in 32, when he went to Los Angeles for the Olympics, it was a very unhappy team. He'd never got on with the chief official. There were rows, and then they found at the last minute that they'd brought the wrong spikes. He was utterly demoralized and, again, failed to do himself justice. We haven't really come to the Otto the Strange thing.
Tell us.
One of the things that he used to do was to roll naked in the snow. He even would take a class of his school kids in the spring down from the mountains when the snow was still lying. They would all strip off and roll naked in the melting snow. Yes, girls included. But you have to remember that this kind of behavior wasn't so rare. This was the time they were naturists, and it was a very strong movement in Germany in the 1920s. It was all considered good for the body. The more sun that you could get on the body, the better.
He wasn't exactly an intellectual, was he?
He considered himself an intellectual, certainly.
So was that part of the strangeness, too, that athletes weren't usually intellectuals?
No, absolutely. He was exceptional and from that point of view. There wasn't really anybody comparable at all. There was the tradition of the British runners, who were mostly university men. And yes, they had university degrees, and many of them became distinguished in other fields. They didn't analyze athletic style the way he did. He was interested in the idea of the whole man, that everybody should do sport, even if they weren't particularly gifted. Well, really, it was a throwback to the ancient Greeks, except that the Olympic ideal among the Greeks quite rapidly became perverted, and they became, in effect, professionals.
And he wrote about such things.
He wrote several books on the subject.
I think you said he wrote 7 books altogether by the time he died.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, there's 2 things that we need to now really develop before we end. We've only briefly mentioned Mauthausen. After Himmler asked him, "Why don't you like women?"
They let him go again. And in fact, he then went into exile in Sweden. When did he go to Mauthausen? 1941. He was actually released from prison the first time in 1935. And then they put him in prison again. Actual prison, not a camp. He was released on parole, as it were, in time for the 36 Olympics.
That's so strange, that combination of war, prison, and then Olympics. It's so odd. I mean, was he revered and reviled? On the one hand, he's put in jail, and the other thing, he's running the Olympics to represent Germany.
No, I mean, he never represented Germany after he'd been put in jail.
Oh, okay.
He was released as an expert spectator in 1936. It's actually a personal appeal to Hitler from some of the athletes, particularly the British. Also, probably there was pressure behind the scenes from his protector, Bussmann.
Mm-hmm.
But in point of fact, he was quite lucky not to have been shot in jail after he was arrested for the second time. There was an announcement in the press that he'd shot himself in jail. And quite possibly the plan had been to shoot him the way they shot Röhm, and maybe at the last minute they decided it wouldn't look very good, you know, to have one of Germany's leading athletes just a few months before the Olympics to shoot himself. The same story, if he'd kept a low profile, he might have been able to spend the war in Sweden. He still had enemies in Germany, and they were on the lookout for any sign anti-German behaviour. He was threatened with being deprived of his nationality. Ultimately, I think he was blackmailed into returning to Germany from Sweden, because if he hadn't done, his family would have been put in a camp.
What was it that he was outspoken about?
It sounds so petty now. He was on the breadline in Sweden, and he was writing articles in the Swedish press. And a couple of times he wrote something which was considered anti-German by some of his enemies in German sport. That was enough to get agitation for him to be returned to Germany.
To Germany, I see. And then when he returned to Germany, that's when he was taken to Mauthausen?
Taken to Mauthausen, yes.
Yeah.
He'd never learnt properly to relate to people.
Mm.
He could be very charming. He wasn't a good mixer, but at the same time, he was admired to such an extent that when the German team competed abroad, he was regularly selected captain. He certainly had this charisma. Through sport, he could relate to people, that's for sure. Sport was his family. He couldn't really relate to his family. Well, for a while, he had to conceal his sport from his family. His father described sport as a breadless art, boardless art.
Can't make money from it.
Eventually, you know, they became proud of him.
He wrote journals and stuff like that, so you were able to get documentation for your book from that?
One interesting small piece of documentation that we got from the Mauthausen Museum in Vienna, his registration. He was originally registered as political, and then that was crossed out, and homo was written over the top of it.
Really?
Yeah. After the war, he wrote about 200-300 pages on his experiences in Mauthausen, and then he tore it up. And a lot of people who went through the camp, they didn't want to relive it. But what he did do, which was extraordinary, was that he actually appeared for the defense of two war criminals. There was a big trial in Dachau, an American-organized trial of about 70 officials from Mauthausen. He appeared for the defense of two of them. He said, they saved my life. They were doctors, two of the camp doctors. He said, as far as I'm concerned, I knew nothing about other activities, and in fact, if you read the detailed reports of the Dachau trial, for a start, because the Americans organized it, and American lawyers decided that anybody who had any function in Mauthausen was per se guilty. They introduced this new concept into the law of a common criminal purpose. Anybody who was identified in any way, you know, even if they just took away the rubbish, they were per se guilty of an offense.
Mm-hmm.
One of the defendants was charged with supplying the gas.
Cyclone
the
B.
Gas capsules. Peltzer had to say was, as far as I'm concerned, he treated me when I was ill, he treated me and he saved my life. And that's, you know, and we even had a conversation about the treatment of the Jews. And this man said to me, well, you know, I do my best for them.
Let's get to India. That's the last part of his life was very much centered in India.
Yeah. It had got to the point he couldn't work in Germany anymore. The anti-homosexual policy was actually, if anything, was even stronger in post-war Germany than it was in pre-war Germany. He got wind that the prosecutor was investigating him, so he thought the best thing was to get out. He got out in 56. He got a job reporting on the 56 Olympics in Australia, and then he started looking around for work. I mean, he was being pursued by some of his pre-war enemies, and whenever he looked like getting a job, they would send word through the consul that this man is a pervert and a communist and you mustn't have anything to do with him. He was offered a job in Iran, and at the last moment that was withdrawn. The same happened in Iraq.
The job was
coaching.
Coaching, okay.
Then he got offered this job as Indian national coach, and he coached so well that when the Germans sent a team over to India to sort of show the flag, to their astonishment, the Indians, coached by Peltzer, beat them. This was sensational. India was an absolute minnow in sport. Yeah. And suddenly they were somebody, you know, they'd beaten the Germans. But that wasn't sufficient. Then some street kids came to the stadium where he was living in the most difficult circumstances and said, would he coach them? So he said, okay. They were street kids, a lot of them. They had nothing. He paid for their basics, even though he was living on the breadline himself.
You say that these kids sometimes brought him food.
So, yes, he coached these people, and some of them reached Olympic level.
Mm.
By this time, he was ill. The time he'd spent in the camp, it was taking his toll. Some of his friends came out to India and brought him back to Germany 3-4 years before he died. The plan was to invite Indians over to Germany and coach the Olympics and so on.
He did that, though, didn't he? Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did that. His favourite, but he did indeed coach him. And it was while he was actually timing him that he dropped dead from his heart attack.
One of the things that impressed me was in Delhi, I don't know if that's still true, that every Sunday they had the sort of Otto Peltzer.
They certainly had it at the sort of almost 20 years ago.
Describe what it is.
You know, the Rajpath in Delhi, it's like the sort of imperial way. It's like the mall, as it were. And apparently every Sunday they have this run along the Rajpath. Whether he is remembered today, I don't know.
Well, he is by your book. It's a handsome book. Big, thick thicket of photographs in the middle and a very long bibliography and reference section.
Yeah, newspaper articles and then, you know, books of just general history of the period.
It's got a lot of educational value about European history. We're talking to Tim Johnston about his book, His Own Man, the biography of Otto Peltzer, champion athlete, Nazi victim, Indian hero. And that's available from Pitch Press.
To be honest, the simplest thing would be to get it online.
Thank you very much, Tim, for a fascinating book.
Thank you, Hazel, and thanks for your interest, particularly from somebody who, in principle, should have no interest at all.
I'm glad that I was able to be interested in the complexity of the man. You make that very clear. So, thank you. That was co-author Tim Johnston talking about His Own Man, the biography of Otto Peltzer, champion athlete, Nazi victim, Indian hero. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs are archived at hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.